This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a moment, we'll talk with Lenny Kravitz about how Michael Jackson changed music in general and his music in particular. Then Brian Monroe joins us as we try to reconcile different aspects of a complicated man whose death prompts conflicting images, the supernova child star, the R&B artist, the king of pop, and the tabloid caricature, the undeniable talent who revolutionized music and the music business, the strange superstar who survived child molestation charges, epic financial difficulties, and multiple plastic surgeries and skin treatments. Which Michael Jackson do you remember today, and what does that say about you and us? Call us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also post a comment on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, retired Colonel Gary Anderson joins us just back from Baghdad as part of a provincial reconstruction team. But first, Lenny Kravitz. In his 2 decades in the music industry, he's become one of the preeminent rock musicians of our time, winner of countless awards, including Grammy for Best Male Rock Vocal Performance 4 years in a row. Kravitz recently mourned the loss of Michael Jackson and talked about his experience working with the King of Pop in a tribute for Spinner.com. And he joins us now by phone. And Lenny Kravitz, nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
How are you?
I'm well, thanks. In a tribute to Michael Jackson, you wrote, "He was the first live performer I ever saw. I got to see him at Madison Square Garden when I was 8. If not for him, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing." Tell us a little bit more about that, if you would.
Well, I grew up in New York City and... you know, I was born in 1964, so, you know, I grew up in a perfect time to catch the Jackson 5. I mean, I heard those records as they were being released and as they were on the radio, and I had the singles, and my father knew how much I loved listening to the Jackson 5, so he surprised me one night. I remember it really well. I mean, I was 5 years old. He came into my room and he said, "We're going somewhere." And I had no idea where we were going. And next thing I knew, we were at Madison Square Garden. I didn't know who we were going to see. And the Jackson 5 came on. Actually, the Commodores opened the show, and they weren't even called the Commodores yet.
Pretty decent act.
Yeah.
I wonder, when was the first time you met him?
The first time I met him was probably about 15 years ago. Prince, myself, and Michael got together one afternoon just to kind of sit and talk. He was at, I think he was at Hit Factory recording in New York, and Prince and I took a ride over there, and we spent the afternoon with him. Hmm. And that was the first time I met him.
And you've recorded with him as well. I know you've worked on a track that has yet to be released. What was he like to work with?
He was amazing to work with. You know, when I'm in the studio, I mean, it's the place that I love the most, and it's magical for me. And we had a very similar work ethic. You know, I write the music, I produce it, I play all the instruments, and, you know, I'm very intense about it. And we just worked so well together, and, you know, he wanted it to be perfect, and he said, you know, just stop me when it's not right, or you don't feel that I'm interpreting it the way that you feel. Stop me, and, you know, let's really get into this. And, you know, we spent a couple of days on the vocals, getting them exactly right, and it was, you know, it has two sides, because on one hand, I'm sitting there saying, "Oh my God, I'm working with Michael Jackson. I'm working with this genius of a musician that influenced me so much." But then on the other hand, as you get into working, you kind of forget and you just get into the work. And it was just two guys working, and it was a really beautiful experience.
Do you have any difficulties reconciling those different images, that kid you saw first at Madison Square Garden, the man you met 15 years ago, the man you were working with just a little while ago?
I mean, you know, there are the obvious physical differences, but at the end of the day, I really don't give that too much energy. I mean, those were his choices. We might confine them to be choices that we wouldn't make, but they were his choices. And for me, it's about the music. Again, something that I wrote in the blog when I wrote that was that if Michael Jackson had never done Off the Wall or Thriller and sold all of those albums that he did in that time, he would still be the super genius that he was.
You're going to miss him.
Tremendously. I listen to his music all the time. The Jackson 5 music, you know, although people at that time called it bubblegum, it actually, I think the term is misleading because you had Motown Records, you had Berry Gordy, you had the best writers, the best musicians there were, and the writing was phenomenal. It was actually quite intricate and very deep music, you know. It wasn't just some pop sort of thing thrown together.
Did he ever talk, or did you ever talk with him about his experiences when he was that child star, what it was like to be Michael Jackson back then?
No, we didn't talk much about that at all. We were really just talking about what we were doing, and at one point when we were eating together, he started talking about just how he felt so sad that the way people were viewing him, and you know, he was very hurt by that, and he actually brought it up, which I was surprised about, and we began to talk about those type of things, just about society in general and how people are and how hurtful people can be.
I wonder, to some degree, he, as you said, he made choices we might not have made, and,
right.
And to some degree, he contributed to that.
In what manner?
In the sense that so many people could see his behavior as strange.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's so deep, his whole thing, because, you know, this guy had been working since he was 5 years old. He'd been pushed. He'd been working his whole life. It's hard for us to understand what he went through, what psychologically he went through as he began to change, you know, that constant drive to be on top. And some could argue that if he hadn't have changed his appearance in the era that he did, he wouldn't have been accepted by so many people. And that's a whole other conversation that has to do with race and looks, you know.
Mm. Lenny Kravitz, thank you for so much time of your time today and for reminding us what it was like to work with Michael Jackson as an artist.
It's my pleasure. Take care.
Award-winning singer and songwriter Lenny Kravitz with us by phone. Also with us today is Brian Monroe. He is the former vice president and editorial director of Ebony and Jet magazine at Johnson Publishing Company and joins us from the studios of Chicago Public Radio. And it's nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Brian Monroe, you did what we understand is the last U.S. interview with Michael Jackson, December 2007 for Ebony. And we're going to play a little clip of audio from that interview. It's a recording that's a little difficult to understand, so you may want to turn it up. This is Michael Jackson speaking with Brian Monroe.
Who wants mortality? I mean, everybody wants immortality. You want what you create to live, be it sculpture or painting or music or composition. Like Michelangelo said, you know, I know the creator will go, but his work survives. That is why to escape death, I attempt to bind my soul to my work. And that's how I feel. I give my all when I work. Because I wanted to just live and just give all that I have, you know? Yeah, it has to be that way.
Again, in that clip, Michael Jackson echoes Michelangelo. He says, "You want what you create to live? As Michelangelo said, I know the creator will go, but his work survives. That's why, to escape death, I attempt to bind my soul to my work." And our thanks to Ebony Jet for the use of that tape. Brian Monroe, that must give you chills listening to that today.
It really does. Over the last few days, I've been going back through my notes and the recordings from that interview, and you know, the power and the intelligence. He was a very serious but also very playful man. We had a good time. It was interesting, that interview. We only thought we'd have maybe 15 or 20 minutes, and it was at the end of we spent 3 days with him. We did a big photo shoot at the Brooklyn Museum, and that went wonderfully. And then the next day we had the interview. And I walk into the room, and actually was greeted. His son was there, Blanket, Prince Michael Jackson II. Mm-hmm. And his son greeted us. And he was about 6 years old at the time. And he had a little candy dish with some Lifesavers in it. And he offered me one, and I said, no, I'm okay. And then he reached out to shake hands. And he reached with his left hand, and Michael said, no, Blanket, your right hand, use your right hand. And so, and it was a classic, I'm a father, my son's the same age, and it's a classic father and son moment, a teachable moment. And that gave us a glimpse of another Michael Jackson that you may not have seen a lot in the tabloid media.
We're talking with Brian Monroe, a journalist, former director, editorial director of Ebony and Jet magazine, who had one of the last interviews with Michael Jackson back in 2007. And we want to ask our callers today, our listeners and emailers, which Michael Jackson do you remember? That child star, the artist who was an R&B star, the strange superstar, the thriller. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can also get in on the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The news broke 4 days ago of the death of Michael Jackson, an enormous surprise. It started a process of trying to sort out the many sides of Michael Jackson. How do you reconcile the many and sometimes conflicting aspects of this man? What does that tell you about yourself? 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can post a comment on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Our guest is Brian Monroe, a journalist, former editorial director of Ebony Jet, who had one of the last interviews with Michael Jackson in 2007. This email from Karen in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. Yes, many of us wonder which Michael we mourn, but those of us over 45 remember ourselves as breathless young black girls for whom there was only one little boy in the world, Michael Jackson. Maybe many of us think we lost Michael years ago, but we cannot divorce ourselves from him, from the way we shaped him and he us. He began as ours. We made him, good or bad, and his talent reflects the best of us, of Jackie Wilson and James Brown and hardworking mothers and fathers who just want to give their kids a chance. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Bakar. Bakar with us from Charlottesville in Virginia.
Hello, Neil. How are you doing?
I'm well today. Thanks.
You see, on the contrary, I don't believe that we shaped Michael Jackson to the person he is today because he's trying to change his personality. He's trying to change his normal being. I do believe Michael Jackson we know today, comparatively, compare Michael Jackson from the early stages because of his father's doing. We have to realize that Michael did not grow like any normal child. His father was a great critic in his life. He made him who he is today. His father told him that he has a big nose. He did not get that from his family. And when he fell off the stage, he decided to work on his nose. His father told him so many things. This guy did not grow up like any normal child. So therefore, what he is showing and what he was showing was what he believed is absent during his childhood. You can see during his shopping spree, he tried to get little things like toys that any normal kid would long to have. I will take my stuff off the here.
Okay, Bakar. Thanks very much for the call. And Brian Monroe, I don't know, did you get a chance to talk to Michael at all about growing up, about his father?
Well, we did. In fact, he told me about growing up and his father and the kids, the rest of the brothers. And I asked him if he was, when they were rehearsing and when they were performing, if any of them got jealous about, you know, his attention and what he was achieving. And he said, well, you know, if they did, they didn't show it. But in fact, the quote he told me, he said, yeah, they never showed it at the time, but it must have been hard because I would never get spanked during rehearsals or practice. Then he laughed. But afterwards, when I got in trouble, that's when I got it. It's true. That's when I would get it. My father would rehearse with me with a belt in his hand. You couldn't mess up. My father was a genius when it comes to the way he taught us staging, how to work with an audience, anticipating what to do next, or never let the audience know if you're suffering or if something's wrong. He was amazing like that.
Hmm.
So there was a very complex relationship. You know, remember Joseph Jackson was the force that brought the Jacksons out of Gary, Indiana to the national and then the world stage. And he was so central to the popularity of the Jackson 5 at the time and Michael Jackson. And he was also a very tough taskmaster. And so there was a duality there that the whole family both loved and struggled with.
There's an email from Lana in Denver. Concerning Michael Jackson, I'll remember a brilliant choreographer and singer, obviously troubled, that for various reasons never got the help he needed. No one is born with psychological problems that Michael exhibited, but many gained from his talent. And never got the help he needed. A lot of people wondered about that entourage that accompanied him everywhere, Brian Monroe. And I guess when you're that rich and that famous and you need people around you, nevertheless, this was a constantly shifting cast of characters who did not seem to be there to help Michael Jackson.
Well, it depended on who they were. There were, you know, he would often on big public events travel with a large contingent. But oddly enough, when we were with him, he had very few people with him. We did the whole 3 days very incognito. We, in fact, were at the Brooklyn Museum. If you've ever been there, it's right there in the middle of Brooklyn.
Yep.
And very few people knew that inside was Michael Jackson. We had a couple of security folks, his team and our team. And then for the interview, it was just the four of us from my group and a couple of folks from him sitting in the room with I'm sitting on the couch about a foot and a half from him we thought we'd only have about 15 or 20 minutes. We ended up having close to 2 hours. I couldn't shut him up. He was very, very talkative and would talk about creativity. The occasion of the interview was the 25th anniversary of Thriller. And so we talked about creativity, the making of the album, the Motown 25 performance that he did. You know, and Lenny alluded to this earlier about the music and the work. And he was indeed a perfectionist. He would talk about how the creative process and how, for instance, in Billie Jean, he did the early rough version of that with his sister, Janet, and his brother, Randy, doing the background vocals on an early version. They called it a working version. And he said, you know, if you take a song like Billie Jean, where the bass line is the prominent, dominant piece, the protagonist of the song, the main driving riff that you hear, getting the character of the riff to be just the way you want it to be, that takes a lot of time. Listen, you're hearing, listen, and I was playing it as we were talking, because listen, you're hearing four basses on there doing four different personalities, and that's what gives it the character, but it takes a lot of work.
Let's get John on the line. John with us from Eagle, Colorado.
Hi there. It's Eagle, Idaho, actually. I'm sorry about that.
Oh, I apologize. That's my mistake. I misread the screen.
No problem. I was just saying that I think that the way that I have I'm 22 years old, and I've grown up listening to Michael Jackson, and I remember my aunt really loved him. And so I think that I had more of an appreciation and maybe an understanding for Michael Jackson than others. But I think that in my generation, you grew up not really seeing the Michael Jackson that had that was part of the Jackson 5 or the Michael Jackson that changed music in the early 80s or the Michael Jackson that was the first black man on MTV. We grew up seeing him as the Michael Jackson that was hanging babies out of windows and the Michael Jackson that was looking less and less healthy and more surgeries and the Michael Jackson in the tabloids. And so I think that there's all these different Michael Jackson for my generation to have to reconcile. And so his untimely death has been something that has forced all of us to kind of come to grips with who Michael Jackson was, at least in this generation's eye.
And for you, as you say, he's that inhabitant of the tabloids?
He was for me for a long time. I grew up listening to him. So for a long time, I didn't understand, as a child, the Michael Jackson that I was listening to with my aunt and the Michael Jackson that I was seeing on television. These two very different men, one who looked very much like an artist and a star, and another who looked very troubled and very unhealthy and very ill mentally. And so I was a long time as a child before you could put those two faces together and recognize that they were the same person.
Yeah, and indeed, thanks very much for the call, John. And indeed,
you.
Brian Monroe, they are unrecognizable as almost the same person.
But they existed in the same body. There were many Michael Jacksons. There was Michael Jackson, the performer. There was Mike, the friend. there was Smelly. He tells me about the nickname that Quincy Jones and Steven Spielberg gave him called Smelly. He said that in the early days, he was very cautious and wouldn't curse much. And when he would hear a song, he would say, so I'd say, that's a smelly song. That would mean it's so great that I was so engrossed by it. So he called me Smelly. And then there was Mr. Jackson, the businessman. And we tend to forget that, you know, he was a brilliant businessman. He competed and bought and owned the Sony ATV catalog, which included the Beatles collection, as well as Elvis Presley, Eminem, and many others that were in that catalog that's worth easily more than $1 billion right now. The MyJack catalog and others. He was a very shrewd businessman, and you know he was also caught up in a lot of financial problems later on in his life. So there are many Michael Jacksons, including Michael Jackson, the father, and Michael Jackson, the brother and the son. And they all existed and sometimes struggled in that same body.
Well, to this point from Leah, I loved his music from the very beginning. His music was my favorite to dance to. But where were the people who were closest to him, his family, who was supposed to love him when his meltdown began? Did they just stand by and watch? This is the result, another star gone before our time. What the relationship with the family? Obviously, you talked to us about his father, which was difficult, I guess. And who were those closest to him able? Were they there for him when he needed them?
They were and they weren't. They were in that on many occasions, you know, they're there as family, as support, as love, as colleagues, as working professionals. And sometimes he had pushed them away as he was dealing with his own issues. I think we culturally seek for absolutes. You know, he was absolutely a brilliant performer or absolutely a scoundrel or absolutely this. And, you know, Michael Jackson was much more complex than that, that he was many things in one. And that some of the, you know, and so you were asking about, you know, what is the Michael Jackson that many of us will be linger with? For me, having seen many of those different sides, I come back to the one thing that attracted us all to Michael Jackson, and that was the music. As a performer, as a musician, he was a genius. I sat this morning listening to some old stuff, and you know, you listen to how he built the songs, and you know, someone like Quincy Jones, who was instrumental in "Off the Wall" and "Thriller," and in fact, they Quincy told me they first met. Quincy said there were only two people that stood out to him, and he met them both at 8 years old. One was Stevie Wonder, the other was Michael Jackson. And in fact, he was telling me, Michael was telling me about working with Quincy. He said, you know, we would work on a track and then we'd meet at the house, play with what we worked on. And he would say, Smelly, let it talk to you. I'd go, okay. He'd say, if the song needs something, it'll tell you. Let it talk to you. I've learned to do that. The key in being a wonderful writer is not to write. You just get out of the way. Leave room for God to walk in the room. And when I write something that I know is right, I get on my knees and I say, thank you. Thank you, Jehovah.
Let's get Andrew with us. Andrew calling from Cleveland.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call. I grew up in Western New York, near Chautauqua Lake, and it's a very agricultural, rural area. And for a 9-year-old kid from that area, in 1984, Michael Jackson was really my first introduction to hip hop and, my first pop icon. I remember distinctly begging my mother for a red vinyl zipper jacket in Jamesway, and she finally succumbed, and my wife and I just came across it going through her estate a couple of years back, and my wife insisted that we not throw it away. But I guess he was always frozen there at that point for me, and not really worship or hero worship, but just I just knew him as this consummate showman. I mean, And all the other stuff, it always struck me that all the other stuff, all the tabloid stuff and the accusations and all that, I always noticed how when I watched him dance or I watched him sing, it just all went away. And there he was. You know, there was...
Some of that stuff we can't forget, though, Andrew.
What's that?
Some of that stuff, though, we can't forget.
What can't?
The other stuff you're talking about, the allegations about child abuse, the disaster that he made of his life.
Well, personally, I think that the worst disaster was really some of the physical alterations. But I mean, even in my own period of watching him, you know, as a pop icon. You know, that was around the time of the Diet Pepsi commercial, and I honestly, I don't think he ever recovered from that. I think it was one of those situations where he could never see past the injury. And, I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but it's just a theory I have, because it just seemed like everything started kind of rapid succession. The alterations started really happening right after that. And as far as the other stuff, I guess I reconciled it by leaving it to the hands of the system. I felt that, you know, I was not going to put that on this extremely talented man if the courts couldn't, if there was no formal, you know, accusation. I always felt to myself that
no conviction,
no formal indictment. I always felt to myself that I wasn't going to put it on there in opinion, and to me, he will always remain the showman.
Andrew,
you know, it's interesting, the showman piece that your caller talks about in that Diet Pepsi, that Pepsi commercial, the image that we remember from it was not just the fire, but as they were wheeling him out, what did he have on his hand? He put on the white glove. That's the consummate showman.
Andrew Monroe, Brian Monroe is with us. Excuse me, Andrew is with us from Cleveland. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go see if we can get another call in. This is Rick. Rick with us from Evansville, Indiana.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to make a couple statements. I'm 35 years old. I'm from a rural area in Indiana, and I grew up as Michael, the pop icon. You know, I understand the tabloids are what they are. They make their statements and things like this. And, you know, he made a mistake. He had mistakes in his life, but you can't erase the fact of his work. He's created a generation of people, and you know, like you said, you know, he made a disaster of his life, but what he created for so many other lives, I would think in my mind, erases that. And to you say the smelly side, yeah, that makes sense. But to a person who is blind, all they ever hear is the music and the art, and that basically makes him the best there ever was. So in my mind, you know, that's what I believe.
Brian Monroe, that clip of tape we played earlier, he talked about the kind of immortality that he might achieve. It's the work. Do you think that's a prospect for him?
Oh, I think without a doubt people are going to remember. And, you know, if you look at just the reality of the last, 72 hours or so, you know, who else could bring the entire internet to its knees around the world, not just domestically, but around the world? Half of Amazon sales during that period were Michael Jackson albums. 9 out of the 10 top iTunes albums over the last 72 hours were Michael Jackson's. If AT&T said that during the peak of the news story, there were 67,000 text messages a second about Michael Jackson. Who else could have that kind of global impact? But it was about the work. I remember he told me about the Motown 25 performance where he debuted mm-hmm. Billie Jean. He walked me through. I had that on a video or on my laptop, and he walked me through shot by shot how he choreographed himself and his brothers, and then even picked the camera angles that he and Suzanne DePass for Motown, every angle and every shot that they were going to do. And then afterwards, he says, "You know, I'll never forget backstage after the performance. There was Marvin Gaye and the Wings and the Temptations and Smokey Robinson and my brothers. They were hugging me and kissing me and holding me. And then Richard Pryor walked over to me and said in a very quiet voice, 'Now that was the greatest performance I've ever seen.' That was my reward. There were people who, when I was a little boy in Indiana, I used to listen to Marvin Gaye, The Temptations, and to have them bestow that kind of appreciation on me, I was just honored. So the next day, Fred Astaire called and said, 'I watched it last night, I taped it, I watched it again this morning. You're a hell of a mover. You put the audience on their blank last night.' Then he took out his left palm and took his two fingers and did a little moonwalk action on his left palm. And he remembers that kind of appreciation. And I think that's the appreciation that many around the country and around the world will call on as they remember the many facets of Michael Jackson.
Brian Monroe, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Brian Monroe, a journalist and former editorial director of Ebony and Jet magazine, with us from Chicago Public Radio. Coming up, we'll talk about the scene on the ground in what used to be one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in Baghdad. This is NPR News.